Craig Silverman, whose blog Regret the Error tracks journalism's mistakes, says a bad moon's rising.
So we're coming off what was, I call, the summer of sin.
CNN and Fox News initially reported, wrongly, that the Supreme Court had struck down the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act. ABC News reporter Brian Ross implied, wrongly, that the Aurora, Colorado shooter James Holmes was a member of the local Tea Party. Interns at NPR and the Wall Street Journal were caught respectively plagiarizing and fabricating. CNN host and Time Magazine editor Fareed Zakaria confessed to plagiarizing. New Yorker and Wired.com writer and best-selling author Jonah Lehrer was caught recycling his own stuff. Is that so bad? And fabricating. That's bad. And the New Canaan News, a Smallhurst paper in Connecticut, according to Silverman, employed, quote, one of the worst serial fabricators in modern journalism.
So a really, really bad summer, and yet when journalists at these news organizations, people in leadership roles were sort of asked to say, well, what's going on and what are you looking into and what do you know as of this point? In a lot of cases, they actually wouldn't answer any questions.
You think it's hypocritical?
It is. If we make it a practice to stonewall requests for basic information about a transgression that's happened, then when we turn around and we do the exact same thing to government agencies or to large institutions in society or companies, they can say, well, you didn't answer questions from fellow journalists when something happened in your house. Why would I tell you about what's going on in our house?
That lesson isn't lost on Ira Glass. When This American Life's famous episode about Mike Daisy's trip to an Apple factory in China, concluding with an indictment of the company, turned out to be largely fabricated, Glass produced another episode anatomizing the errors and the process and agonizing over the breach of the listener's trust. That's why we're talking to him again this week. Actually, for the third week in a row, he's sort of becoming our Andy Rooney.
Brooke, have you ever thought about fact checkers? I mean, I've really thought about it.
But the potential fallout from the Daisy episode was no joke.
I mean, my fear was that people were going to ask, well, what about everything else you've ever put on the radio? I feel like we can't let this happen again as a staff. We can go to our audience once and say, like, oh, we messed this one up, but we cannot go to them a second time. So now we're spending between $300 and $1,000 a show on fact checkers. We set aside $60,000 in this year's budget to hire freelance fact checkers, people who work for, you know, national magazines and the New York Times magazine. And I want the stories to be right.
Different media outlets handle checking in different ways. On our show, we scrupulously research our guests, prep ourselves, and even fact check during the interviews. We're not live, so we can do that. We still make lots of mistakes, so we have a link to corrections and where listeners can report errors on our homepage. And we notate the transcripts to reflect the original error and the fix. NPR's All Things Considered produces up to 10 interviews a day. That's a lot of vetting, prepping, and post-interview follow-up. And so, says executive producer Chris Turpin, correct they must.
And it's why we took to running letter segments pretty much every day, which we didn't used to do. We are the first draft of history. We shouldn't pretend that we don't get things wrong on a regular basis. We have to work fast. We try very, very hard to get it right. But yeah, of course we should fess up when we don't get stuff right. We shouldn't be mealy-mouthed about it.
Has the operation changed at all in this fact-fraught season, when it seems everyone claims entitlement to their own facts? Has there been a tweaking of the process?
I'm not sure entirely how you can tweak the process. Many people, particularly in the political realm, don't believe that they have to actually have any connection to the facts. You know, as you say, that creates a kind of peculiarly kind of postmodern discourse at times. And it's like, well, how do you deal with that? If you put on live coverage of the Democratic and Republican conventions, you would need a Roman army of fact checkers to keep up with the number of potential misstatements or, you know, partial truths that are being disseminated, and I think that that's an almost impossible task.
For a daily radio show, how about a weekly magazine famous for the most rigorous fact-checking in the land?
I have 16 people in this department, including myself, and at any given point, there are typically 8 or 9 languages that people speak fluently.
Peter Canby oversees fact-checking at The New Yorker.
Mandarin, Arabic, Urdu, Russian, Italian, French, Spanish.
He says New Yorker fact checkers do reporting in reverse.
In other words, we take pieces apart and put them back together again. We talk to the writer's sources. We also try to get to people who were mentioned in the story who maybe the reporter didn't even speak to. If we have a secondhand characterization of somebody else's activities, then we will try to either get the reporter to go to that person or go to that person ourselves just to get their perspective on things.
But what happens if the primary source disagrees vehemently with the characterization or the quote of the reporters? How do you know who to trust?
Well, that's an excellent question. We get notes and transcripts from reporters before we call people. And then if somebody starts trying to back off something they clearly said, then we would say to them, sorry, we're offering you a chance to fix things that are factually wrong and not to rewrite your interview. Naturally, that tends to be kind of a conversation stopper. So when that happens, we would typically go right away to the writer and to the editor, and then we have to iron it out.
Craig Silverman of the Regret the Error blog believes that in the future, the fact-checking of breaking news will make far greater use of the news consumer. In fact, he says that kind of fact-checking has already arrived, performed by NPR's social media dynamo, Andy Carvin.
He has found a way to transform his Twitter feed into an instant newswire about events in the Middle East. And he does that by choosing the right people to follow, by engaging with people on a constant basis, interviewing people and talking to people. One of the other things that he does, he might retweet somebody reporting that bombs have just fallen in one area, and he'll retweet it, but he'll add proof, or can you add a photo?
Carvin's interactive process offers the kind of crystalline transparency that Silverman craves. And yet, the very culture of fact-checkers is rooted in invisibility. When a Time magazine editor hired its first fact-checkers back in the 20s, they were exclusively young women.
Because while he considered this fact-checking to be important, it wasn't so important that he would hire men to do it.
He sent a memo around about the ethos of fact-checking. He says, any bright girl who really applies herself to the handling of the checking problem can have a very pleasant time with it and fill the week with happy moments and memorable occasions. The most important thing to remember in checking is that the writer is your natural enemy. He is trying to see how much he can get away with. Remember that when people write letters about mistakes, it is you who will be screeched at.
There's a lot in there. I mean, wow, you know? And what I think is certainly true to this day is that typically people only notice fact checkers if some terrible mistake has been made.
Oh, it's a perilous biz.
Do you have proof that your genitals look like the Virgin Mary?
Can you confirm that you own a red Corolla?
Can you confirm that bootcut jeans are so last year?
Perilous, but not manly. That's the central joke of the Funny or Die web series FCU, Fact Checkers Unit. Hear the daring fact-checking duo pray at the altar of Alex Trebek.
Dear Father of Facts, please give us the strength to conduct this research quickly and properly. Amen.
That old Time magazine editor sure was right about the screeching. The howls over Neil Ferguson's recent Newsweek cover story about the president are still reverberating. Media outlets these days are enthusiastically eating their own and each other, just like they did back in the days of the penny press. And maybe that's a good thing, but it's not for the delicate or the dainty. You can't run, and you certainly can't hide. Not anymore.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.